From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. On today's show, we'll speak with Mike Kunzel, a director at the Roosevelt Institute, where he focuses on economics, inequality, and the role of public power in a democracy. We'll speak with him about his new book, Freedom from the Market, America's Fight to Liberate Itself from the Grip of the Invisible Hand. Then Shalonda Baker, professor at the Northeastern School of Law, joins us. She'll explain what she calls revolutionary power, an activist's guide to the energy transition. That's coming up in just a moment. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The free market, we are told by its proponents, is the best path to prosperity for all. Free enterprise is a right that subsumes other rights. Freedom from regulations will unlock wealth. This is the myth that America is steeped in. Rarely, if ever, do our politicians demand that we center our freedom to live full lives, work reasonable hours, access healthcare, etc. But American history is filled with a struggle to define freedom as centering on human needs. Telling that story in a new book is my guest, Mike Kunzel, a director at the Roosevelt Institute, where he focuses on economic inequality and the role of public power in a democracy. He is co-author with Joseph Stiglitz of Rewriting the Rules of the American Economy, and he joins me to discuss his new book called Freedom from the Market, America's Fight to Liberate Itself from the Grip of the Invisible Hand. Welcome to the program, Mike.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So, as I mentioned, we have these myths surrounding American and, you know, that are really that fill American discourse, media discussions, and certainly political debates. And it seems to have perverted the very idea that America is supposed to be founded on, which is freedom. How did it come to be? Before we get into the history, how did it come to be that the notion of freedom and the free market convinced so many of us that that's the freedom that will lead to our freedom?
Yes, that is one of the most important questions of our time, is how our economics and the view of our freedom being tied up with our ability to become market actors, to exist in markets, and that markets themselves are viewed as a kind of freedom or place of freedom, is really an intellectual hijacking of notions of freedom and autonomy that we've had for centuries. You can, you know, date it back, you know, 40 years, maybe the last 60 years. Historians really do debate so-called neoliberalism or the changes that since the 1970s in both the way the economy functions, who it functions for, and how we view it. And it's telling that even though a lot of the proponents talk in terms of so-called free markets or small government or giving government out of the way, they're often very aggressive when it comes to using and structuring markets to enhance the power and dominance and freedom of owners and bosses as opposed to everyday people. And what this book tries to show is that, you know, that water that we swim in, that ideology of freedom as a type of market and market is markets as freedom, has not always been the case. So the book tries to explore in decades and centuries past how we used to talk about things differently.
Right. I mean, the notion of free market as a sort of fundamentalist worldview began to become popular, particularly among progressives in the 90s. We had the anti-globalization movement. And then, of course, in the early 2000s or the mid 2000s, we had the Occupy Wall Street movement. And we are seeing now a revival of some of those historic notions of redefining freedom to actually center around human beings. Today, we see, you know, rising inequality and really starkly high numbers of young people in particular, in spite of the propaganda against it, choosing socialism over capitalism. Is that something that is a direct consequence of the very palpable failures of free market capitalism?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it is telling how poorly the economy has run in the last 40 years under this kind of new economic ideology. The rate of growth has slowed. Economic mobility, the chance that your kids will be better off than you, has declined dramatically, and certainly has not increased, even as inequalities increase, where the top 1% income earners have doubled their share of the economic pie over the last several decades. Increasing economic concentration, power of corporations, the profitability of corporations, even as they are investing less and innovating less, is really telling. We have this very stagnating economy that comes with this new economic regime. And you know, the book comes out of my experiences the past decade, going back to the Great Recession, to the foreclosure crisis, to Occupy. People started to really ask questions, I think, more aggressively, even though they have always been there. And I've really seen a resurgence in the last 5 years. The campaign for Fight for 15 movement for a high minimum wage, Medicare for all, and you know, even in this crisis, a resurgence in popular discussion of care work and social reproduction, things that academics and activists have tried to bring to people's attentions. The actual crises, the multiple crises we're living through, have really brought them into everyday people's lives. And whether or not it's daycare during World War II or segregated hospitals under Jim Crow, these questions about access and freedom, for the ability to lead our lives, have been with us for centuries. And the book really tries to give us a historical depth outside of the immediate crisis that we're in to help us understand that there have been people who have fought for a better and different world.
Those who critique the demand for greater government intervention accuse the rest of us of wanting free stuff, right? And this is quite an insidious way to undermine the cry for better access to healthcare or to be free of college debt, etc. This idea that Americans just want free stuff as opposed to wanting to be free of debt bondage is also quite insidious. And this too is this myth that pervades American society, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Whether or not you go back to the Homestead Act, where President Abraham Lincoln ran on "Vote Yourself a Farm," that he would give free land to people, obviously taken from Indians and tied up with the history of settler colonialism, but still the idea was there that people should be given a baseline to be able to lead the lives that they want. Free college has been the norm for centuries. I think the most popular tweet I think I've ever written was a 1950 UCLA student handbook, but just on page 40 casually mentions, oh yeah, college is free, as it has been for centuries. There is a specific campaign executed by conservatives and centrists to force colleges to become tuition-based and to create a mechanism to force not just people to take on student debt, but to change their understanding of themselves as citizens, that they are not entitled to an education, that it is not the promise of the United States to, however awkward and not living up to its potential, but the promise of higher education to be able to collapse the distinction between mass and elite education. That was taken away from people. And I think showing people that you know, like, it's not just about like free stuff. It's about how we determine the role of markets in our lives. Markets perpetuate inequality. They discriminate by nature. They have a requirement for if you're sick, you don't get healthcare. You need to be sick and have money, or sick and have money to buy insurance. You know, this extra way that markets create unfreedom is so alien to how we think in the past several decades, but has been with us for centuries, and people have understood it. So I think forcing people to get back into that way of understanding these social problems helps open up the potential to understand that these aren't like weird or obscure demands, or demands that go to our very nature as a country.
And this idea of free stuff and the accusation for people wanting free stuff really links the fact that, of course, it's not free. We do pay for it. We just spread out the responsibility to pay for it through our taxes. The government takes our taxes to give us stuff and ensure everybody is, should be ensuring everybody is taken care of. And so that aspect of the equation, of course, is rarely mentioned. So let's look at history. Your first chapter in your book, Freedom from the Market, is called Free Land, which you referred to earlier. Tell me about the history of how the American experiment, you know, really was based on quote-unquote free land, which, of course, as you say, is very much linked to settler colonialism.
Yeah, absolutely. So starting in the 1840s and 1850s, when it was clear that the slave power in the South wanted to extend a regime of race-based chattel slavery to the West Coast, south into South America. There was a movement of people who wanted to keep the Western frontier, the unsettled lands, free from slavery. They also wanted to keep it free from corporate exploitation, from just essentially being sold off for mineral rights and land rights. They also saw, however imperfectly, the idea that you could have a free citizens built around free labor, that you could avoid some of the degradations that come with wage labor, that you could still maintain this idea of freedom by structuring the Western lands, which of course were taken through conquest. You could structure them to help promote a certain kind of citizen who is more free than the alternatives being promoted by corporations and by the South. And, you know, there was, it did do a lot of successful things. Now, the book also discusses and closes with the Southern Homestead Act, which failed to do what it needed to do, because it would not take land from slaveholders and give it to the freedmen. And that failed, that showed how important it is to maintain a vision of evolving freedom when it comes to these questions. I think people who thought that a certain kind of baseline freedom would be sufficient did not understand the real forces that would be brought to bear against Reconstruction in the South. And so, it's an interesting history. It's more varied than the one I understood from school textbooks and growing up. And it's one reason I thought a lot about whether or not to include it, but that the Homestead Act is understood in a very vague way by a lot of Americans, and actually understanding the complexities of it and the way it tied into Reconstruction, I think is really helpful. Really helpful for us out here as we really want to reconceptualize what wealth means in our country.
The idea of free time is one that has an interesting history as well. Today we continue to fight for the 8-hour workday, even though it's an idea that we think has been around right from the beginning. It was something that was fought for. And of course, because of the failures of the free market, there are still far too many Americans that work far too many hours because they make far too little money to support themselves from just 40 hours a week. So that 8-hour workday and its history is one that, you know, socialists in particular like to cite, progressives like to cite as something that was hard won by an organized labor movement. Tell me about your view of this history.
I think it's super fascinating. One reason I can pick some of the things that I do is that the resonance with today is so vivid and so real. I think, you know, people talk about working 20 hours, but I think one thing that also really stands out in today's labor atmosphere is environment is the lack of control a lot of people have over hours. You know, a lot of workers, especially in the increasingly dominant service sector, have very little control over the hours that they work. That they won't know them in advance of a week. Sometimes they won't even know them in advance of a few days. And it's very hard to have the kind of deep networks and deep communities if you don't have some control and some understanding over where you can carve out time from having to earn money to live. And that was really relevant 100 years ago. It's the way people talked about it. It's actually relevant almost 200 years ago. In 1835, probably the first general strike in the country was launched in Philadelphia around the idea of a 10-hour workday. And because people understood as they were learning what wage labor would be, that its ability to colonize our days and leave so little over for our families, our friends, our communities, our civil society, it was just devastating. And they fought very hard over centuries, they're still fighting today, to be able to not only exercise control within the workplace through a union, through proper labor laws, but also put a limit to the extent that it and how far it will go and how far bosses will colonize our day-to-day lives.
So this notion that corporations have the freedom to mint their money and make their profits, but we don't have the freedom to demand certain rights, how much of this is based on this modern libertarian worldview that we're all sort of proto-millionaires in the making, that we're all, you know, poor and at the whim of corporations because we simply haven't worked hard enough or aren't smart enough to be the CEO and are at the bottom?
There's definitely that's definitely an element with that. You know, in the book, we obviously talk about people who have a financial interest and in keeping things commodified and fighting government efforts to provide public programs or suppress the extent of the market. But I also try to spend some time with other things outside people who just profit off of it. You know, we spend time with the court system, which has often been very conservative, which fought to overturn efforts to limit the working hours that we face. And I talk a little bit about ideology, and there's definitely, we talk about volunteerism, which is the sense of Americanness that thinks that if we just put a little bit of grit into it and get together with our communities, we can solve things locally or in our communities. We don't need the government to step in. And, you know, that's really great for barn raising. It's really great for building communities, but it's not actually sufficient to tackling the real insecurity and precarity built into modern capitalism. Capitalism will not allocate resources to people if they're not working. And all of us are not working at some point in our lives. We get sick, we're children, we're elderly. We can become disabled, and at which point we need insurance. We need insurance against that loss of income. And that spirit of volunteerism often, as noble as it is, would interfere with our ability to seriously tackle these problems in a profound way. And we still see it now where I think there's a sense that maybe with GoFundMes or, startups or tech apps, we can kind of solve a lot of the problems of precarity that's built into the system. And we can't. It will never operate at the scale necessary to do so. And that was well known 100 years ago, and it's still with us now. We still need to learn it.
Let's talk about the FDR presidency and that historic moment where we saw the successful pushback against the notion that markets deserve freedom, but humans don't. How do you view that? The New Deal, FDR and the New Deal, coming after the Great Depression within the grand scheme of American history, and how we've sort of seen that New Deal unravel.
Yeah, so, the New Deal has so many contradictions and so many parts to it, and there's parts of it that are very awe-inspiring, parts of it that are caged by the power of white supremacy in the South and the control of Southern Democrats over the legislative process. It changes throughout time, over the course of its 12 years or beyond. The real thing that jumped out at me in writing this book is how much they built on ideas and how much the notion, so the parts I cover, there's so many things to cover with the New Deal, and I work for the Roosevelt Institute, which is a nonprofit partner of the FDR Presidential Library. Cover Social Security, which is an effort to provide social insurance against the fact that capitalism will not allocate income to people when they're elderly, when they're sick, when they're disabled, and also the Wagner Act, which tries, and for a period successful, in bringing some sort of democracy into the workplace, giving some workers a say outside of their ability to just bargain and leave their work job. And you know, each of them, the thing that jumped out at me is at every point, people are really talking, they're not talking about market failures. They're not talking about this would be nice to have. They're not talking about, you know, this is something that, you know, is something we should owe people who get left behind in the modern economy. Their arguments for them are really tied up with freedom. Labor calls the Wagner Act America's Magna Carta. You know, like there's really a sense in which these programs promote freedom at a fundamental level that the market itself cannot and will not provide. And I think that way of understanding big, bold programs, besides, in addition to their impacts on our lives, was really important because without it, we're left at the mercy and unfreedom of market dependency.
Then we have an issue that you tackle in your book, Freedom from the Market, that is even more relevant today as we are navigating a pandemic, and that is the issue of healthcare. We still remarkably today are being told, even by our incoming president, who's from the Liberal Party, that Americans do not have the right to expect the government to ensure we all have healthcare when we need it. It is linked to our employment or our age. You know, certain groups of people have the right to get it from the government and most others don't. How did that evolve in the United States? Has there been a moment in US history where the freedom to access healthcare was, you know, a real thing compared to now?
Yeah, so as you know, there was efforts across the early 20th century at the state level and at the federal level to push for a universal healthcare, single payer style healthcare package that would ensure everyone has access to healthcare in the way that there were in all of our peer nations. It was not included in Social Security for any historians debate why, but it was you know, the American social insurance system was so thin at that point they thought that that was too much of a push. Instead, what happened was it was submerged among employers through the tax code, which is to say, you know, this was sort of accidentally done in World War II, but then Republicans and conservatives and members of the medical establishment pushed for it to be formalized in 1954, which was basically saying, like, you know, your employers will provide your health care and they'll get a tax deduction for it. It ties it with work. It ties it with people getting more benefits when they make more money. And ties it with people who have precarious work, who are unemployed, or people who have jobs that don't pay that much, making it a lot harder for them to get it. But also, it essentially is a government program that delegates it to the private sector, delegates the responsibility for carrying out this thing. And we know that the private sector is just not going to be able to do that at scale. There is a real efficiency that comes when everyone contributes and everyone is covered. And that's why people push for things like Medicare for All, the expansion of Medicare, or robust public options, because they understand that the government's footprint gives us the ability to address these problems in an equitable way. This was well known in the 19-teens when people first started to really discuss healthcare, was that, you know, that there would always be this push to try to get charitable organizations and private actors and private businesses to try to contribute and take care of this problem, but they ultimately can't. They don't have the pockets that the government does. And, you know, it's telling that this has always been a flashpoint because it's really speaks to the ability of the government to provide social insurance and really is a hassle with not just the financial incentives of insurance companies, though those are profound and more than sufficient to fight reform, but the ideological idea that private actors should be the one, that we should be dependent on the market for our ability to secure healthy lives. You know, that's repulsive to a genuine notion of freedom, and it's why people fight against it, and they continue to do so today.
Finally, the centrist liberals in government have often nodded to the notion or given a nod to the notion that we all deserve, you know, freedom from some of these ills, but their solution has been often piecemeal, has come in the form of tax credits or programs that you have to apply for, and, you know, plenty of hurdles along the way, pouring money into certain kinds of resources. Why is that? Why do you think that this notion of government directly benefiting its citizens through the taxes that we directly pay it is still such anathema, even among the liberals in our government?
It's a good question. I think it goes to the market ideology we've been talking about over the last several decades. I think there's an element of a lot of those liberals are just like insecure. They're like, they don't believe that the government can really do this without the private actor or without private businesses and the profit motive.
We are constantly told that we have to worry about those who are already wealthy, benefiting from, you know, some of these direct kinds of aid. I mean, this is something that Republicans and even some Democrats have said, for example, during the COVID relief bills that are passing. Oh, well, we can't give $2,000 to somebody who's already making $100,000. Therefore, we have to restrict it. You know, but a universal program is a universal program.
I think that often betrays a presumption that's not always well articulated, but that the idea that the role of the government is just to prevent people from falling into absolute destitution, which they don't even really do because they don't
have
a basic income. But that there's this kind of like, if we prevent the worst case scenario, we've more or less solved what we have to do, as opposed to structuring and suppressing markets such that they promote genuine human freedom, which involves large, expansive programs. So I think there's a weird ideological thing there that's not always stated, but I think it's, you know, absolutely important to make sure that the worst off are benefit from the economy. But that's not sufficient, I think, for what really harms people out here in the 21st century. The second is one of the reasons I spend a lot of time with the New Deal period, as compromised as it is that at that point, people thought we should just have large government programs. You know, I talk about World War II daycares, and, you know, women were employed in munitions factories and building up factories. Because of mass conscription, there were just fewer workers, and there was much more need during World War II. And so women were brought into the labor force in a huge sweep, and the government just provided daycare to women. And they did it really rapidly. It took about a year to get thousands, I think tens of thousands of facilities up and running that were largely successful. Now they were rolled out in very quick circumstances, but it shows, much like parts of the CARES Act from last year, that the government can work quickly if it wants to, and it can do so in a bold, direct provision way. And we don't think that way quite as much anymore. We want things to run a lot slower and more confused, I think, often just so that people won't appreciate what could the world we could really have.
Right. I mean, if you think about during the when the pandemic began, you immediately had leaders ensuring that all COVID testing would be free or come at no cost to Americans, that the vaccines would be free and come at no cost, that even treatment, which is something that not enough people know, that those who have been stricken by COVID and may not have insurance are generally supposed to, at least in theory, not be saddled with the hospital bills. When it came to this one disease, they were able to free Americans on paper and in practice to an extent of the obligation to have health care. But if you are unlucky enough to have a non-COVID disease or health condition, it's back to the free hand of the market, and you're on your own, sink or swim. It's just quite remarkable to see that.
Yeah. And it's weird because on one hand, you know, the government was able to move money pretty quickly. You know, checks went out. The government was able to staff up unemployment insurance in a very profound way, and unfortunately went into a system that had grown quite brittle and weak because of purposeful disinvestment at the state level, itself a history of conservative courts going back to the 1930s, which I talk about in the book, the reason our unemployment system is so brittle. But they still were able to, you know, give people more money than they were making to not have to work during a crisis, which is exactly what you need in the middle of a pandemic. And unemployment insurance, you know, like you actually saw poverty levels stay the same or even go down in the second quarter of last year, even though unemployment was double digits and we were technically in a quasi-depression event, precisely because the government can move that fast. On the other hand, during the Trump administration, you often saw essentially this kind of like Articles of Confederation style government planning to try to secure PPE and secure the infrastructure to fight COVID that states were left to coordinate by themselves, which they were poor at doing. Private sectors were really emphasized as the buyers and suppliers. The various kinds of military style production weren't invoked. It'll be a question about how well and how quickly President Biden will be able to do that this year. I know there's a big focus on really ramping up that infrastructure to execute something that we saw not be done very well last year, left to the private market, which dragged its feet and did not do a great job.
Well, Mike, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and telling us about your book. Good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
My guest is Mike Kunzel. He is a director at the Roosevelt Institute, where he focuses on economics, inequality, and the role of public power in a democracy. He is co-author with Joseph Stiglitz of Rewriting the Rules of the American Economy. And we've just been discussing his new book, Freedom from the Market, America's Fight to Liberate Itself from the Grip of the Invisible Hand. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As the United States transitions to a new presidency, attempting to put 4 years of Donald Trump behind us, Mr. Joe Biden has a flurry of initial actions planned, including rejoining the Paris Accords and putting an end to the Keystone XL pipeline project. But according to my next guest, climate action needs to be rooted in local actions and policy, and most importantly, in justice. Shalanda Baker is a professor at the Northeastern School of Law. Before joining Northeastern's faculty, she spent 3 years as an associate professor of law at the William S. Richardson School of Law at the University of Hawaii, where she was the founding director of the Energy Justice Program. In 2016, she won a Fulbright Award and spent a year in Mexico exploring energy reform, climate change, and indigenous rights. She now joins me to discuss her new book, Revolutionary Power, An Activist's Guide to the Energy Transition. Welcome to the program, Shalanda.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
So as we are transitioning to a Biden presidency, on the broad federal level, do you see hope on the horizon, especially as compared to the 4 years of Trump when we are talking about climate change and even climate justice?
Sonali, there is no comparison. I mean, we're talking about night and day. So we think about the Trump administration, it was very much a systematic dismantling of environmental protections for communities of color, most notably, waiving requirements for polluters right in the middle of the pandemic, even when we were beginning to learn more about how exposure to air pollution made it more likely that you were going to suffer, bleak consequences as a result of COVID-19. So the Trump administration has taken a very cynical approach to environmental protection and very much driven by profit and driven by sort of, again, rollbacks. The New York Times itself did an analysis and found over 100 different regulatory rollbacks in that administration. And so as we turn the page to the Biden administration, we're already seeing with some of his top picks a very different approach, starting with Michael Regan, the head of the EPA, a Black policymaker from North Carolina, which I should say is where the environmental justice movement really took off, in Warren County. And so, you know, that signals his appointment, and again, it needs to be Senate confirmed, his appointment really signals a shift in terms of how we're thinking about environmental issues. I think similarly, setting up a climate czar, if you will, in Gina McCarthy, she will be right at the White House driving climate policy. That signals a real attention to climate change as an issue. And Gina obviously comes out of the EPA. She's now going to be the outgoing president of, or president and CEO of the Natural Resources Defense Council. So she really has the technical chops to drive climate policy. She was one of the architects of the Clean Power Plan under the Obama administration. And as her deputy, she has Ali Zaidi, who comes out of New York. New York is a leading state in terms of climate policy. Just last summer, Governor Cuomo signed into law the Community Leadership and Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, which really makes a commitment to frontline environmental justice communities. And so I think with this team that also includes John Kerry as an external international climate envoy, we're really set up for success. And I would be remiss without mentioning the Council on Environmental Quality, which is where a lot of the environmental justice work in the administration happens. And we have Brenda Mallory, who is coming from the Southern Environmental Law Center, really driving and leading a lot of initiatives there. And she's a veteran to government work. And one of her key deputies there will be Cecilia Martinez, who I think of as the mother of the environmental justice movement. If that long answer didn't give you any clue, I'll just put a fine point on it. And that is, you know, we're headed in a vastly different direction with this new administration.
You write in your book that your main objective, quote, is to model an approach of justice first in pursuit of averting catastrophic climate change rather than one of climate first, justice later. What do you mean by that? What have you been worried about in seeing the approach to tackling climate change?
Yeah. So, Sonali, I'll answer that question by giving an example and an anecdote from my own background and my own life story. So I left practice as a corporate lawyer way back in 2009 and found myself in 2010 in January living in Oaxaca, Mexico, which is very much ground zero for Mexico's energy transition. And when I say energy transition, I'm talking about the transition away from fossil fuels to clean energy. And so when I got to Oaxaca, I actually met indigenous peoples who were fighting against mega wind, massive wind development. And as I dug into that issue, I realized that they were being dispossessed, displaced, divided, not to use too many D words, but you know, all of the bad things that we connect to fossil fuel and fossil fuel development were happening in Oaxaca. And Oaxaca, again, is a remarkable place for any of your viewers out there. I recommend it. But it's also home to no fewer than 14 distinct indigenous groups. It's one of the poorest places in Mexico. And the place where all of this wind energy development was taking place is called the Isthmus of Tehuantepec. And it's a small stretch of land that happens to be one of the windiest places on Earth. And so starting from my time in 2010 to now, we've seen an exponential growth of wind energy development there, and very much a grassroots indigenous movement against that development because they're simply not benefiting from it. And now Oaxaca has the proud distinction of being a place with one of the highest, if not the highest, concentration of onshore wind energy in the world. And again, that type of dense development, extractive development, that is not benefiting them at all. And so I had the opportunity, as you mentioned in lead up and in my bio, that to go down to Mexico in 2016 to serve as a Fulbright scholar. And, you know, I was there to really look at and explore and do research connected to the transition, Mexico's transition. They just opened up their markets to private investments for the first time in over 100 years. And, you know, I had the opportunity to sit down with a policymaker who was at the equivalent of the Department of Energy, but in Mexico. And I said, what are we going to do? You know, how are you going to address these social and environmental issues related to this transition? And you're running over the rights of Indigenous peoples in this development. And he said, Shalonda, climate change. We have to do this because climate change is an emergency. And so again, this is a mentality of let's avert climate change first and then worry about issues of equity. But what is lost in that analysis is the understanding that the very people that you're sort of running over in your race to avert catastrophic climate change are the ones who are on the front lines who will receive the very worst impacts of the climate emergency. And so I argue in the book that we should be centering those communities and centering their concerns in this transition.
So are you worried that the same structures and the same institutions that have fomented climate change are going to be handed the reins of getting us out of this crisis and therefore leave out the issue of justice and human rights? I mean, we see even fossil fuel companies and financial institutions, you know, sort of come late to the party and decided that they are now going to work toward addressing climate change, of course, in the hopes of making money from it. But that may be a massive, that may, you know, be fraught with pitfalls.
It is absolutely fraught with pitfalls. And I think we need to be really careful about who we empower in this transition. And I think we need to interrogate the structures that we have come to except as a natural part of the fabric. And by structures, I mean our approaches to energy policy, our approaches to electricity rate making, as well as our approaches to, you know, the types of actors that we're relying on to shepherd us, you know, out of this dark place with, you know, the heavy reliance on fossil fuels to clean energy. And I, you know, very skeptically view, you know, the fossil fuel industry as it attempts to sort of change hats, you know, in this new moment. So I think you're absolutely right to voice some skepticism on your end and also cynicism even with respect to the types of actors that we're relying on. And so I would argue that, again, all of it is on the table. We know that we have a legal system that is rife with inequality. We know that there's so much structural inequality all around us. And I would connect the struggle for, you know, racial justice within the criminal justice system to the struggle for racial justice within the energy system. You know, no part of our society has been spared by structural inequality. So it follows that our electricity system and that our energy system are similarly burdened by racial injustice.
Tell me about your time in Port Arthur, Texas, which you write about in your book, and how that is in many ways an example of the environmental racism we have seen, and can offer a guide to how climate change needs to focus on justice.
Right. So Port Arthur, Texas is the birthplace of the modern fossil fuel industry, as well as its current spine and epicenter. It's also a low-income Black and Latinx community, and it is a part of what is broadly referred to as the Golden Triangle, which is to say that on a satellite image, you see lights lighting up this particular part of the Texas-Louisiana border area, and that area is lit up because of all the petrochemical and fossil fuel facilities that are concentrated in this particular place. It's also been called Cancer Alley because in many ways it is what we would call in the environmental justice community a sacrifice zone. So that place has been sacrificed in order to provide cheap energy to the rest of us in this country. It also happens to be the place where my father grew up, And my father worked in the electricity sector for the local utility. My grandfather worked for, Chevron. My uncles also worked for the oil industry. And so it is both the benefactor as well as the thing that has made life for people in that area so difficult from an environmental standpoint. We have cancer rates that are higher there. We have all sorts of other maladies that are high due to their status as an environmental justice community. And so I had the opportunity to spend a little bit of time there when I was around 8 years old. And I took it, my parents were split, so I had a chance to go down with my sister. And we spent a summer there, and I really got to know that place. I fell in love with it. It was, you know, for me, such a foreign land. I grew up in Austin, which is very urban, and Port Arthur is semi-rural in some ways, and it's on the bayou, and there's a fishing culture, so people are crabbing and fishing and eating fried fish for dinner, and the accents are different. I mean, I couldn't understand anything going on half the time. But I fell in love with it. And as I pulled back many, many years later, I mean, I'm talking about in the last couple years, and really began to dive into my work on energy justice and environmental justice, I realized that Port Arthur is so crucial to our nation's energy story. And I'll give you one stark example that was very much my entry point into Port Arthur as a study. Back in 2017, I was, you know, fastidiously following all of the news and developments around Hurricane Harvey. And, you know, late one night I was scrolling through the New York Times, and there was a Facebook Live video posted, and a young man was on the video saying, "Help us, please help us. We are in knee deep water. We need help, we need help." And this was a young man from Port Arthur. And that young man happened to be my half brother. So that was the moment where it hit me that I have a stake in this transition, and I have commitments based on where I come from to tell these stories.
You write that utilities reform is the linchpin to transforming the energy system. And in addition to Mexico, in addition to Port Arthur, Hawaii and the state of Hawaii is a very important model for climate justice, but also, you know, showcase how that whole struggle unfolded. Tell me about what Hawaii can teach us, you know, for those who are lucky enough to have traveled there. One thing jumps out at people, which is that rooftop solar is almost everywhere on mm-hmm. any of the islands. Many of the islands have, you know, homes that are just dotted with solar on their rooftops, which could be the case in many more states around the nation, but isn't. Why?
Right. So Nali, I love that you read the book and found it so compelling. It's like, yes, that was the goal, to really make, you know, these technical energy topics come alive, and for the stakes of our transition to really become tangible to the reader. And so I had the privilege and honor to go to Hawaii in 2014, and I joined the faculty at the University of Hawaii School of Law. And I got there at a really exciting time. So as you say, Sonali, rooftop solar was everywhere. And at that time, there was about, I think there were about 17% of all of residents there had rooftop solar. So that's almost one in five. It's extraordinary. It was the highest rate of solar adoption in the country at that time. And so at the same time, the utility was pushing up against that and saying, whoa, 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 this is too much distributed energy generation, because that rooftop solar was taking away from their ability to, their bottom line, essentially. You know, when you generate solar on your rooftop, you're getting a discount. You're selling your electricity back to the grid, as opposed to having to pay the provider for your electricity. And this was cutting into the utility's profits. And so they're making a range of arguments, including that the grid was too unstable to allow for so much electricity going back into the grid. The grid was designed to push it out to homes. They were making the argument that rooftop solar hurt poor people, because it was leaving them with the cost of maintaining the grid.
And this is an argument you hear over and over and over again, yeah, in so many different arenas. You know, here in California, where I am based, you hear any arguments usually pushed by corporate lobbyists that anything that is there to hurt them or their bottom line really is an insult to poor people and working people and people of color?
Well, here's what I would say in response in terms of the insults, right? Rooftop solar isn't the insult. The insult is placing fossil fuel generation in communities of color. Mm. The insult is the disproportionate burden that homes, low to moderate income homes, are paying for electricity. Our electricity rate design is regressive. That means the poorest people are paying more of their overall income to just keep the lights on. That's an insult. That's the issue that utilities should be tackling, rather than trying to end rooftop solar, which actually lowers emissions, if we think about it over a longer time horizon, in the very communities they say they care about. That's my response to that. So it's a very sort of cynical, disingenuous approach. And so all of that was kind of happening in Hawaii. It was the preview to what we are seeing around the country. And for me, it was just like a kid in the candy store. What I realized, going back to your original question, is that utilities were at the heart of all of these debates. And they were at the heart of all of those debates because of their business model. They're incentivized to sell electricity. They're incentivized to build infrastructure, to build stuff. And the regulator in the state, and I'm making it sound like a soap opera because it really felt like a soap opera then. Mm-hmm. The regulator in the state, the Public Utilities Commission, said, utility, you are slow walking our clean energy transition. You must innovate, or you're going to be regulated out of existence. So either you can play a role in this transition, or you need to step aside because climate change is real. And, you know, distributed energy is something that we need for resilience and for a whole host of reasons. And so I got to witness that. And that's why utility justice and utility reform have become such a central part, I think, of my analysis regarding our energy transition and how to do that in a way that is just.
And of course, on the mainland here in the United States, you see, many people who might love to have solar on their rooftops if they're lucky enough to be homeowners, or simply be able to draw their energy from solar and not have to live near, say, a fracking well, but simply don't have the money to make that happen because they're busy putting food on their table. So how can the Hawaii model be expanded to local communities, to utilities across the country, because it shouldn't be that cost prohibits people from being able to have rooftop solar.
You're absolutely right, Sonali. So there are three key ways people can get access to solar. They've got the savings and they can buy the solar panels outright. Okay. You know, we know who's privileged enough to do that. And we know kind of how wealth disparities have played out in this country. So that's not a lot of Black and Brown and Indigenous people. The second way is, you know, you can go to the bank and get a loan to have them buy the solar panels and you pay off that loan.
Or there are companies that just lease it to you, which is what I did for my...
That's the third way.
Oh, I see.
So the third way is the leasing model. And I think all of those ways or of accessing solar are kind of put on top of a society that is structurally unequal. And so, you know, the folks who are able to benefit from those particular models are not low to moderate income people, right, due to credit score and due to, you know, even access to banks, which we know redlining has made difficult in certain communities.
And all of them involve either going into debt or having, large nest egg to invest into it.
Exactly. And so what I would say is that everyone pays their electricity bill. Right. And studies have shown that this is one of the first bills that people pay, even when they're at the margins. We should use the electricity bill as a vehicle, as a mechanism to allow for on bill financing of solar, which would mean, you know, the utility is essentially carrying that risk, and we could back up that risk. I mean, now I'm getting back into my corporate law kind of corporate finances, but we could sort of provide a backstop to that risk with things like green banks, which are, you know, sometimes formed by a legislature, sometimes formed by other capital investments. But, you know, there are ways to manage that risk. But we know that electricity and energy are fundamental human rights. And so we have to figure out a way to get broader access to that. And I should say that the disparity in solar access in communities of color isn't just for low to moderate income folks. It exists in middle income and higher income communities, and there's a racial component to this. I suspect that it's due in part to the largely white solar industry. I mean, there are reports and studies showing that the solar industry itself is not diverse. So we've got to diversify the solar industry. We've got to create not just jobs for installers, which is noble, and hopefully those are union jobs, but we need to create businesses that are owned by people of color so that they're seeding solar in their own communities.
So finally, there's so much more to talk about, but we're sort of limited by time, and I can certainly encourage people to read your book and you know, start to spread these ideas. When we think about the transition that needs to happen, do you worry that there's going to be far too much opposition to delivering what needs to be delivered as fast as possible without worrying about who it's impacting? And at the same time, we do have a pretty vibrant grassroots Black and Brown and Indigenous-led movement now, more so than we did 10 years ago, demanding climate justice. You know, we have the call for a Green New Deal, which has, of course, been rejected as too radical. But, you know, in terms of which path you think the United States will choose, especially under a President Joe Biden, what are your hopes or fears?
I have only hope. We're not going back. We are not going back. And, you know, the president has, Joe Biden has made a commitment to move 40% of all climate investments to frontline environmental justice communities. And I take him at his word to do that. And I think the folks who he has filled his administration with are committed to those goals and understand what's at stake in this transition. And so, you know, we're not going back in the same way we're not going back to accepting police violence against Black bodies and brown bodies. We're not going back to a world where people of color are on the wrong end of this transition. And we can only move forward. And I have faith that it'll either happen in government or people on the ground will insist that it happens. So we're not going back.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Shalonda, good luck with the book.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. My guest has been Shalonda Baker, professor at the Northeastern School of Law. Before joining Northeastern's faculty, she spent 3 years as an associate professor of law at the William S. Richardson School of Law at the University of Hawaii, where she was a founding director of the Energy Justice Program. In 2016, she won a Fulbright Award and spent a year in Mexico exploring energy reform, climate change, and indigenous rights. We've been talking about her new book, Revolutionary Power, An Activist Guide to the Energy Transition. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at Rising Up with Sonali. Sonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Kitsap. Like us on Facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.